Welcome to season two. This is the season two premiere of Crippled by Culture, where we talk about everything in life and relate it to the disabled and chronically ill community. My name is Sean Gold, and I'm an author, advocate, and nonverbal public speaker for the disability community. To provide a quick visual description for accessibility, I'm a Black man with a white tracheostomy breathing tube in my neck. I'm wearing a white shirt. The person off camera is who you hear speaking for me. This video is of a Zoom call with me and the person talking for me off camera. And my guest is in the other box next to it. Today, I would like to thank Adam Ross for being my voice in this episode. In this episode, we are talking about the intersections of disability, the medical system, Black pain, and community organizing. The following episode contains detailed description of traumatic events that took place in medical settings, strong themes of ableism and transphobia. Viewer and listener discretion is advised. Now, let's get to today's amazing guest. Dr. Punch loves to heal. Okay, educated in medicine at the University of Connecticut and trained in surgery at the Shock Trauma Center in Baltimore. This desire to heal has brought to life a career with a threefold focus: education, trauma, and healing. Moving to Ferguson, post-Ferguson, he collaborated with numerous stakeholders to create The T, a community of health-promoting holistic healing from trauma related to bullet injuries and overdose in St. Louis. The T transforms healthcare delivery through education and anti-racist relationships-based education, engagement, and direct care. This includes the creation of the Bullet-Related Injury Clinic, BRIC, and The Key, which is a harm reduction program with a focus on overdose risk, both centering the experience of Black men because hashtag Black pain matters. And of course, that is more than just a hashtag because it's true. Dr. Punch, thank you so much for being here today. How are you doing?
Well, I'm blessed, and it's so good to be in space with you today, Sean.
Thank you so much. So glad that you are here with us. And would you mind giving a visual description of yourself, please?
So I am Dr. LJ Punch. My pronouns are he and they. I'm sitting in a room with the light gray walls and a colorful rainbow tree behind me. I have on thick, dark glasses, and I am caramel in color.
I appreciate that. And first, do you identify with having a disability or chronic illness?
Sean, have been through an incredible journey over the last 10 years as I have explored the experience of being neuroexpansive with my son, only to discover that I share with him being on the spectrum and being identified as autistic. Now, I don't view that to be a disability, but it's certainly a different ability. And it's been life-changing to come to understand that about myself, even as I support my child in his development.
Yeah. And how would you say that discovery affects your everyday life?
So it's filled me with a great deal more curiosity and compassion about anything that we call a deficit. Because behind every disease, diagnosis, disability, as we name it through conventional healthcare, is a super ability, a superpower. And discovering that in myself has allowed me to find so much more asset in the people that I care for, the people that I work with, the people that I... By recognizing that every time something in you works or is structured in a way that deviates from the bell curve of humanity, right? You push yourself and you must move toward overcoming that. And that same quote unquote difference might give you capacities and abilities that no one else can even imagine. And so I think having that has, first of all, given me a great deal of curiosity and compassion. But the other thing it's done is it's caused me to be able to ask for accommodation for myself when I need it. And so in asking for accommodation for myself, it's much easier for me to understand when others need it as well.
Before we get any further into the interview, I want to give a shout out to our partnering nonprofit festival for the series, Festability. As the media director, I help organize a wonderful event in St. Louis at the Missouri History Museum. We have so many activities and vendors set up all over with an amazing headliner for our main stage each year. It is the best event in St. Louis to celebrate your disability unapologetically while celebrating the Americans with Disabilities Act. Make sure you come out if you're nearby. Check out the link in the description to learn more. Thank you, Festability, for sponsoring the series. Now, back to the show.
And would you say after having discovered this through your journey with your child, do you feel like there are other things going on for yourself that you feel may not be diagnosed?
Well, it's interesting because I'm also trans. Certainly many people characterize that identity as also being a disease, you know, gender dysphoria is described as a pathological process, a process where something is not normal. I very much, again, do not internalize that value in any way and view my trans identity as another profound source of the superpower, but also one that requires accommodation and attention. And so I think one of the other ways I, you know, that this has impacted me is to recognize how intentional everyone has to be about their health and well-being. Just for some, culture and circumstances and structures support it sort of automatically. And for others, they have to do a great deal of work to pursue their well-being, as I have. So that reality is, and again, Sean, it's not caused me to have a life that's less than. It's only enriched my life. I guess it's just I had to live long enough to understand that.
And do you think that it's overcoming, or is it just finding ways to adapt to your disability, would you say?
I think it's both, Sean. So in some ways, I've had to say, listen, there's just certain things I can't do, and that's okay. So the overcoming is finding a different path. I'm going to sit that one out. I'm not going to ask myself to be in that kind of sensory environment. I'm going to separate myself from certain energy. Like, if I say being autistic is my superpower, then cynicism and sarcasm are my kryptonite, because I can't tell, right, when someone's being cynical or sarcastic. It really hurts me. So I make an accommodation and I say, you know what, I'm going to overcome that by either naming it and telling people, I don't know what you just meant. You have to explain yourself to me, or just holding a boundary and being like, that's not good for me. So that's, I think, overcoming by, again, making accommodation. But I also think just standing in the joy that I'm so glad my neuroprocessing, my gender identity, and my humanity isn't defined by some really, really rigid schema, because it's exactly that freedom that has allowed me to innovate and create healing space for people of all ability.
Yeah. And, you know, connecting back to this idea of internalizing things, and there's this idea of internalized ableism. Did you have to go through any of that? Have you worked through any of that?
Oh my gosh.
Has that been part of your experience at all?
100%. And I have to say, it's some of it I'm really not very proud of, but I have to admit it. I'm not just a physician. I was a practicing academic trauma surgeon. So in the world of medicine, that's on the like jock end of being a doctor, right? I mean, that's like, you know, ER, lots of intensity, lots of adrenaline, lots of ego, lots of power, and life and death on the line. And it was completely, it wasn't just about your ability, your ableness. It was about super ability to not even need to tend to your basic physical needs. This idea that you could not sleep, not eat, be busy all the time, and just go, 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 and you're a machine. So just completely letting go of that entire construct for the BS that it is. It's not helpful. It's not true. And it's actually caused a lot of people I know in the world of medicine and surgery to be deeply harmed. So I didn't just have to deal with the internalized ableism, judging myself and not accepting my ways in which I'm differently abled. I had to actively and have had to actively let go of the myth of the superhero, because that was just basically essentially self-harm, programmatic, sustained self-harm. But I'm going to tell you, the sort of badge of honor, right, to be able to not just physically perform, but perform against all odds, was really, really, there was a lot of clout around that. And letting that go and not falling back on it now and being able to say, no, actually, I do need to sleep. I do need to eat. And I want to see my family. And I don't want to work every day, all day. That was some really serious internalized ableism that I had to overcome.
Yeah, that's very, very relatable. And yes, to all of that. And the inner acceptance part you mentioned, It really seems like that's a really big thing that has been helpful with the internalized ableism, what you say about like accepting your experience with autism, accepting that there are some situations where, you know what I'm saying, like where you will need certain boundaries, or like exactly what you were mentioning. How do you fit that idea of inner acceptance with that? It seems like it really fits in there.
It does, but it's even more than that. And this is one thing I love about you, and I've been watching you, Sean, and it's been encouraging me, which is to also stand as a Black, queer, differently abled person. Because now you talk about intersectionality. That's a whole train wreck. That's a lot of intersections, Sean. And so, but every step of the way in which I say, no, I'm enough. Enough, and I'm whole, and I can be all of who I am and enjoying being myself. That's actually gives me more and more power to overcome those internalized ableism, internalized hatred, internalized homophobia. All of those self-hating mechanisms crumble a little bit more when I step into all the parts of who I am. And I think, once again, I will say that's exactly why I now have the power to look at other people with so much, I think, compassion. Because I'm like, hey, I see you and all the pieces of you, and they all matter. And you might not even be able to love yourself, but I can. And let's start there. You know, a big body of the work I do is not just around the bullet-related injury clinic, the BRIC, but it's around, as we said, the work to support people who are at risk for overdose. And that work's happening through the T. We used to call it the key, but now we call it the T again. And that work, you have a body of people who have been told for years that they're worthless because they use drugs. And for me, I just see someone who's adapting to their trauma and doing their best to survive. And it's only because I have been able to love myself in that way can I stand there with them and see how their abilities and disabilities are interacting and help them think about what steps they can make to move forward in their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. It's beautiful. Why did you want to become a surgeon?
Why did I want to become a surgeon? So it's a good question. First of all, as an undergraduate, I was studying biology because I genuinely liked cells and the way they do their thing. I think cells, and I think life, the condition of being alive and animated is fascinating. I like biology. So I was studying biology, and if you're studying biology as an undergrad, at least when I went to college, you were likely surrounded by people who were pre-med. And I had no intention to go to medical school when I entered college. But being surrounded by all these pre-med folks, it sort of seeped into me. And then I had a really devastating experience with my own mental well-being in college that really inspired me to want to become part of helping people find relief from mental and spiritual suffering. So I took a year off after college, and I looked at being a social worker, and I looked at being a pastor, and I looked at doing a PhD in neuroscience, and none of those things really felt right because I wanted to do it all. So being a physician was the best way to do it all. So that's how I ended up applying to medical school and going to medical school. And then in medical school, I thought I was going to go into psychiatry, right? Because that's what I was the most interested in. But I found my aptitudes, right? The things I was actually good at, to be in the physical domain. I had a very hard time doing medicine in my head and on a piece of paper. But if you talked about tubes and pumps and pressures and structures and organs, like the physical construct of the body, it really made a lot of sense to me. And I found that I enjoyed spending time with the surgeons. I enjoyed how they thought about the body and health and disease. And I liked physically operating on people. So that's how I ended up a surgeon. And then in surgery residency, I ended up pursuing trauma surgery because I realized that trauma was the disease process that made the most sense to me as well. When I play a sport, I'm the happiest when the other team has the ball. I'm a defense player through and through, like anything, whether it's everything from chess to playing Uno. I like it better when someone else is, you know, and I'm sitting there trying to figure out, you know, I'm responsive. And so I trauma surgery was a great way to put all those things together. And I didn't know 20 years later that I'd be doing this kind of trauma care. That's beyond the knife. I say now I still do trauma surgery. I just cut without a knife. But it's all about the idea that when our bodies are threatened, we go into a certain kind of response, and that response can almost be worse than the injury or the threat in the first place. So how do you help people heal from that? So I, along the way, had a bunch of different forces that pushed me toward the medicine I practiced that were not necessarily all coming from my mind. They were just me responding to the environment and the things that I saw. But I'm so grateful for the work I do now and the ways that I'm able to use my physical knowledge of the body to help people even heal spiritually.
Wow, that is fascinating. Your journey from, and the discovery along the way, because it sounds like you couldn't have planned it from the very beginning. It was maybe in that same vein of the self-discovery and self-acceptance, maybe.
And here's the thing, the really interesting thing is that the things I talk about, think about, and do now are more similar to the things I talked about when I was 20, and I'm 48 now, so the things I talked about when I was 20, it's almost as if I've returned to the core of what I've always known was true. And this process of becoming was really, in some ways, also coupled with unbecoming and just getting to the core of who I've always actually been, which is, again, what I desire for all people. And I actually think discovering my disabilities led me back to who I actually have always been.
Wow. Yeah. And, you know, going back to the intersectionality as well, having and being all three intersections or all of these multiple intersections, it can also feel like you're ignored as a person, yet still having access to knowledge that many people, you know, may overlook.
Let's talk about it. And I struggle with that now, Sean, because there are very few people in my life who I feel like can actually understand me. And it's so frustrating. It's one of the things I long for the most. But I have to be understood is one of the things I long for the most. But I have a few people in my life, including my wife. I got married last year. Yes, very exciting. who do know me and do understand me. She's actually known me for 25 years. And so that it's enough for me to understand myself, but it is a gift to be understood even by a few other folks, including her. And I'm very grateful for that, because that's been a big part of that healing, that for me.
That's beautiful. I love that you find ways to share this in your work. So in the medical field, have you experienced specifically transphobia with colleagues or with patients or anything like that? Is that something that you feel comfortable going into at all?
So first of all, because I went through all of my training and early career, not fully out and not transitioned, I presented I guess it was, or it was assumed, because that was the world around me, that cis and hetero, I heard some of the most awful things be said about the queer community in the operating room. The operating room is like a supercharged locker room where one or two people are having power over someone's life. That's the attending surgeon. And everyone else is there to help them do whatever they're doing and is subjected to whatever it is they're doing and saying. And so I used to say it was good in medical school that they would let you wear a mask in the OR, because then they couldn't see your face when they were saying all the heinous things that they were saying. And as a student, especially back then, 20 years ago, you couldn't say anything. I mean, this is a time when Disney was canceling Ellen DeGeneres for coming out on our show. Like, this is, you have to remember, this was different. And so, like, that was in my career, in my lifetime, that it was like that. So I think the sort of message loud and clear was that it was not okay to be queer, and being anywhere along the gender expression continuum other than cis was just a no way, as a non-starter. So I saw other queer surgeons struggle immensely, deeply inside the closet, never coming out, never expressing their full selves. And that added to my internalized queer phobia. And so that happened to me for a long time. And it was fueled by an environment of total intolerance, which was, quite honestly and respectfully, I say this, dominated by cis white hetero men. That, I mean, that was the world of surgery for me. And then I did, toward the end of my academic career, where I still was employed by a large healthcare system, transition into my non-binary identity. And I found very little support. I had mentors say, what is this about? What are you doing? Like, who are you? I had, within the last 6 months, a nurse just yell at me and say, I don't know what to call you. I was in fully into my transition, but my legal medical name, because it takes forever to change all those documents and not changed yet. And between my pronouns and my name, the nurse just couldn't handle and just literally yelled at me. So I've had all kinds of phobia, and mostly it's intense settings where certain culture rules and people cannot stand it if you ask for accommodation outside of their schema when it comes to gender and identity. And so, yes, I have. Let me tell you where I haven't experienced, though, transphobia, and that's from my patients. I was really worried as I was transitioning. And I tell you about, I've had some to say, I'm proud of you, doc. I mean, they have been so supportive. And when I think about it right now, I've simply never had a patient come for me or express any kind of anything. And frequently, especially because a lot of my patients now are Black men, they deeply value having a Black masculine body person in front of them, caring for them. So I think the last place where the phobia comes is from within. And like I said, every day I'm healing from that. So yeah.
Very, very real. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And, you know, obviously it's awful that anyone is going through this. And I hate that you have experienced that, but I'm so glad to hear that your relationship with your patients has been what it is. That's mm-hmm.
Awesome. Yeah. You know, Black men in medicine are the, like, other than people of indigenous heritage, the most underrepresented group. If you look at the statistics from the early 2000s, you have the same percentage of medical students enrolled, 3% being Black men, from the 70s to now. And so it is a huge issue that as a Black masculine bodied person, the chance that you will encounter a physician who shares your identity is exceptionally low. And although identity alone is not a foundation for care, there are studies that are now showing that for Black patients, if they live in spaces where there is a higher concentration of Black doctors, their health outcomes overall are better. And it really actually does matter. So again, to be able to bring this representation, although this is true for Black physicians in general, and also to stand in this posture that I'm, as I say, not binary as well, there are even fewer folks who share that identity. And so, just like I said earlier, what seems to be something that others could call a disability or a problem or an issue has actually become a superpower.
Knowing that the life expectancy, specifically for trans Black people, trans Black women, men, non-binary trans people, how do you hold that knowledge as a doctor and having the experiences that you've had and, you know, living with the identities that you live with, what do you think about that? How do you think about that idea of the life expectancy being lower, not just for Black people overall, but specifically for trans Black people?
So let me tell you, you ready to get real with it? I'll get really real with it. So again, I've shared that one of the bodies of work I do is to take care of people who have been shot, people who have bullet injuries. And I recently met up with a Black-owned firearm safety training group that I had worked with and known before. And it had been a minute since I saw them. So I had transitioned since the last time I had spent time with them before the pandemic. And I went to talk to them about what they're doing and how they're doing it. And I respect them deeply. They have a philosophy, the best gunfight is the one that never happens. And I totally appreciate their approach to responsible gun ownership. And as we were talking, we were going through a bunch of things, and the owner, one of the owners, he looked at me and he said, you know, Doc, I got to tell you as well, like, I'm really proud of you. I'm really proud of how you've transitioned and how you're showing up and how you're doing the work. And he said, and I'm also concerned for your safety, because truth is, you look at the numbers, the identity that you represent is one of the most vulnerable. And he's like, you know, I really want you to think about how you're protecting yourself. And I was like, wow. I mean, it just got really real. It got super real. Because, you know, I've postured myself and in my work and in my life, I always say I'm a lover, I'm not a fighter. I'm here to help and support and help people heal. I never have really thought about the idea, my own safety, that I represent as a Black man, as a Black trans man, one of the highest, most vulnerable populations to dying from a bullet, myself. I mean, just sort of facing my own mortality in that moment, my own vulnerability, it was trippy. It was trippy. I'm still working through it, to tell you the truth, because it's not just from an acute injury, from the chronic stress of walking through the world. in a place, especially a state like Missouri, that wants to erase you and have you just not be. And so for this reason, like, yeah, I am thinking about it in a whole new way. And I'm not exactly sure. I mean, part of me says, I'm not afraid of death. I am living the life of my dreams. I work hard. I pray hard. I do my best. That's like, I got to make choices to be safe. Now, here's an example. Like, I don't know if you want to make a time reference for when we're having this conversation, but it's Sunday Pride today, right? And I specifically made a decision to not go, partly because I'm tired and I don't do stuff on Sundays. I try to keep some kind of downtime. But another reason is, I don't know. Like, there were so many safety warnings, you know, about Pride this year. And I'm like, I don't know. Like, do I need to add so to my own risks? So it's, yes. I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say is that what you just asked me is something I'm literally thinking about right now in a whole new way. And that's really important to me. And it's something I got to grapple with a little bit. I will also say that it also is making me think about how I feel obligated to create some kind of safe space for that trauma release and healing for trans folks. And we actually recently just did an open house where we had all trans healers providing somatic healing and holistic care and listening space for trans people. And it was all people of, it was focused on people of color. So I'm really, really, really excited to see how not just, you know, day-to-day safety and how I can improve that for myself, but how I can pour back into the trans community and say, hey, you know, we take care of each other because we know we can be safe with each other. And that's been both of those things have been a new focus for me. And they're both things I'm really thinking a lot about right now.
Yeah. And when we're living in a mostly red Republican ran state, we mm-hmm. have to be even more careful mm-hmm. when it comes to the public pride events and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in general. Right. Can you talk a little bit about why students are being taught that Black people, and especially Black women, can endure much more pain than white people? And is that something that goes back to the days of chattel slavery in the US?
100%. You know, there's the famous, I should say infamous, Dr. Marion Sims and the unethical, immoral experiments and research he did on the bodies of Black enslaved women to gain knowledge of obstetric anatomy, physiology, and practices, and performed a number of procedures on Black enslaved women without appropriate anesthesia, and then turned around and did those same procedures for white women with appropriate anesthesia. So that, Sean, is not just a historical reality. This is something that is literally still in nursing textbooks that talk about Black folks having higher pain tolerance. It's totally still in books that are in print. But I think it takes a particularly, I should say, overt turn when you look at the way medical professionals deem certain diseases, illnesses, situations to be more left to the realm of criminality than to the realm of medical or social care. So again, the work I do focuses on bullets and overdoses. And there is very little compassion nor care for folks managing those two sources of trauma in their life. And when you talk to people in the healthcare world, and even students, frequently those experiences are deemed to be ones of criminality and not ones warranting healthcare. And so, in other words, it's not just what people are taught overtly in a book. It's what they're taught covertly through the way medicine prioritizes certain disease processes and ignores others. And that's a place where racism can really, really, really creep in. I can't tell you how many patients I've cared for who have had profound pain after being injured and were basically told, there's nothing wrong with you. But it wasn't necessarily that they were told they didn't have pain. They were told you don't have a reason to be in pain because no one was really recognizing the injuries they actually had. And so, yes, it's horrible. It's so damaging. And it's something I spend a lot of time structuring in my education and my efforts with the folks that learn from me now, to the point where in my clinic, the first question we ask you is, what is your pain score? Are you in pain? And we don't just ask the question, we give you something to treat it right away. So that we're signaling to you, this is a very different medical experience. Your pain matters. We're going to treat it and take it seriously because so many of our patients have experienced having their pain ignored.
Yeah. And, you know, in general, there is a lot of stigma around being disabled, shame around being disabled or chronically ill. Specifically, within the Black community, though, why do you think that this stigma shows up in the way that it is, where people are ashamed of maybe identifying as disabled or just being open about a disability or chronic illness? Is that something that you've observed?
Oh, totally. And I tie it completely to and identify it as a result of two very different forces. On the one hand, real talk, Black folks can't afford to be differently abled or disabled. Because if you think about that in the history of Holocaust time, chattel slavery, and all kinds of waves of oppression against the Black body, those who were not fit, right, were the ones who were cast away first. And so in some ways, admitting, identifying, or engaging with a disability is a death sentence inside a Black body. If you look at that history within the United States, that's super important. But you also have the way in which caring professions, whether it's education or healthcare or social care, have under-resourced differently abled, disabled Black bodies. And so when someone is constantly, again, it's like what I said about pain, when someone is constantly telling you there's no reason for you to need this thing, you almost talk yourself into this idea that you shouldn't ask. And in other words, I have a lot of patients who, when they first come to us, are like, well, I don't really have anything wrong. And then we almost have to reverse that and help them really step into the, well, we're not saying anything is wrong with you, but we still know something's going on that you need support with. And here's why, and here's how we can tell. In other words, you almost have to convince somebody that they need care because they've been gaslit into the idea that they're not worthy of care. And that, woof, Black bodies carry that burden in the United States in a way that's singular.
Yeah. And not be deserving of care.
Right.
Yeah, profound. And, you know, this talk about the pain and invalidation of pain and, you know, whether someone is deserving of care or if their pain is deserving of, you know, care, treatment, anything. This reminds me of when I broke my femur. It was the worst pain in my life. And this nurse came in to give me my pain medication. She connected the syringe to my feeding tube. She did it correctly, but it all went on my skin. And the nurse left, and I looked at my mom, shaking my head, immediately saying nothing went in. And I'm not bullshitting. I know nothing went in my stomach. And we told the nurse. The nurse didn't believe me. They had to pull my cover back, and the sheets were all the pink from the medicine that never went in. And so why is it difficult for the healthcare system to believe us? You know, that is the question that just comes up. Why is it so difficult to believe us?
Well, first of all, oh, there's so many layers. And one layer creates the foundation for the next. So if you think about the scenario you just described, first of all, the nurse has already made a decision about you, which is that you're seeking out drugs or pain medicine for some reason that's other than the fact that you're in pain. Right? That nurse has already made some calculation. Now, that calculation is from a deep stigmatized culture that is as deep as the war on drugs and the way that Black bodies were criminalized through the war on drugs. So that's we don't have time for that one. That's another interview, Sean. But you have that baseline idea. And then you also have something that's true for all bodies, which is the way that we in the healthcare profession have been taught to think about pain as a sort of on-off switch that we only can treat in one way, and that we want to just rush past. Oh, okay, we'll treat your pain. Let's just make that complaint go away. Instead of really giving people a broader array of tools, because what's sad to me about this story is not just that they messed up the medicine and then walked away, but that they didn't stay with you and really help you with other techniques to help you manage your pain, which is something I do a lot with now. Everything from breathing techniques to acupuncture to CBD to a whole lot of other things in between that are far better ways of managing pain. So you've got assumptions, you've got schema, you've got bias. And then you have the fact that the healthcare world just doesn't want to deal with people's pain, or it wants to deal with it in a very binary way. And it's really, really, really tragic. And so the healthcare world doesn't listen to anyone's experience of pain in a way that's particularly great. But if you add to it those schema and assumptions, you're right, they won't listen. And I can't tell you how many times I've had people tell me, it's like they don't care. And, you know, the individual people doing the care might not necessarily, they might care a lot, but the system is not set up with the idea that Black pain matters. No, it's not. And that's, again, why I do a lot of what I do in my work now.
Yeah. And this was when I was just 13. I was 13 years old.
Goodness gracious, it's terrible. I'm sorry that happened. It's, they were wrong for that. They were just wrong.
just wrong. And you mentioned how broadly people's pain is not necessarily being met with the utmost care. Black and non-Black people.
Right.
And so, but specifically for Black pain, how would you say, draw the line for us, that the healthcare system, at least in the US, is profiting off of Black pain?
Oh my gosh. So I think there are two very different ways I could answer that. But the first is specific to my training and discipline and experience. Let's talk about it. Trauma, or the bodily experience of energy transfer, is best cared for in a trauma center. And a trauma center is a place where there's lots of different specialists and resources available in one place so that somebody can, in a timely fashion, get all the stuff that they need. To be a trauma center is to perform that care at a level one, a level two, or a level three level. Across the country, trauma centers are certified at those three levels. And if you're a level one trauma center, that's the highest level. So level one trauma centers have to have a lot of resources, and they do best when they can recruit really, really high quality physicians and teams. Now, one of the things that really differentiates trauma centers is how many patients come to their center, because they have what's called a penetrating trauma injury, a bullet injury, or a stabbing, because those injuries are particularly time dependent and really, really dramatic in the kinds of care that they might need. So here's how systems profit from that reality. When a healthcare system is home to a trauma center, they can bill for all of their care with payers, insurance companies, at a higher level, because they're basically running their healthcare system at a level one level. So the idea is, oh, this care wasn't just a small little hospital. This was a big center with all these resources. So you can bill for everything you do at a higher level. What does that mean? It means it is financially profitable. I'm talking real cash, dollars and cents, to have your hospital be the home of a trauma center. And that trauma center will pull in the most highest qualified staff if that trauma center has a lot of penetrating trauma, bullets and knives. So there is absolutely zero incentive for any healthcare system to decrease trauma, and specifically penetrating trauma, in any city, in any place. Because if there's a lot of penetrating trauma, they can justify having a trauma center, which causes their whole healthcare system to be able to bill payers at a higher rate. That is a racket. It's a full-on racket. And I will say it out loud. I've tweeted these facts in a whole long tweet. I have said them in multiple talks, and it is harsh, real talk, but it's important, because we need people to know that the group of people who are in charge of treating bullet injuries have absolutely no investment financially, no incentive financially in preventing those same injuries. Black pain equals cash. In that instance, there's a direct line. It's not a wave. It's not, you don't have to, it's not a zigzag. is a direct line, because in those same centers across the country, the body's most likely, right? Or the bodies, I guess, at a higher level to experience those injuries are Black bodies, are Black masculine bodies.
Why would you say the medical profession, or would you say the medical profession is more focused on finding cures to disabilities and chronic illnesses rather than finding accommodations to manage symptoms and chronic pain? What is your perspective on why the medical profession seems to be so focused towards curing disabilities and chronic illnesses?
So it's interesting because I would say the medical establishment is not interested in curing chronic disease and disabilities as much as it is diagnosing and treating discrete expressions of those chronic diseases and disabilities, right? Why? Because that creates a discrete interface for the exchange of money. So what I'm talking about is the concept of the billable diagnosis. So if you go to the doctor and let's say you have the chronic condition of having high blood pressure, right? Just managing that on a day-to-day basis or making accommodation for it doesn't really create much money for that doctor, right? But if you have an episode of decompensated heart failure and they treat you with these complex sets of medications and workup, and then they improve it, then checkbox, they've done something, they have a highly lucrative billable diagnosis, and no one is accommodating the fact that the reason you have high blood pressure is the environment you're in, the work you have to do, and the daily stress of being a human in this space. So this, the issue to me is not that there's a push to cure, but there's a push to exchange diagnosis for dollars. Accommodation means to me, or the way I think about accommodation, the way I practice it is through the practice of harm reduction. So harm reduction says, I'm not going to fix anything because you don't need to be fixed. What I'm going to do is I'm going to work with you and your goals for your health and well-being and support you to achieve those goals, whatever they are. And that does not create sexy billing codes. That does not create dollars. It simply improves people's health by supporting their self-agency. And that's just not, again, a lot of this, Sean, is because of capitalism. And it's one of the reasons why I've rejected conventional healthcare practice, because it is so enmeshed, not just transactionally, but even its values are based around how much money can be made from the healthcare interaction. And I can't abide that. It's horrible. And you're right, because I think for folks who are differently abled and disabled, it leaves you with this sensation that you are not doing the right thing or things aren't going well unless you're being fixed, cured. And yeah, that is a not helpful approach to what it is to live with a superpower. Because I don't want my superpowers to be cured. I simply want to live with adequate accommodation. So yeah, totally, 100%.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that. And can you tell me a little bit more about the tea? Actually, can you tell me, like, when was it funded and just what do you do there?
So it's a little bit of a branding confusing thing because there's actually three different entities. I began in 2018 with a group of all volunteer nurses, students, residents, community members, with a group that we legally named Power for STL. And it's POWER, the number four, STL. And when you look at it, it looks like the word powerful. And the idea was that we wanted to shift the power of healthcare resources to the community. So that's how it started in 2018. We did not have funding, and I paid for the work through some consulting work I did on the side. But it was a very, very small budget and a very small group of people who did a lot of really, really good work. Because in the first 2 years, we taught almost 10,000 people the national Stop the Bleed class, which is how you can be a first responder if someone has a life-threatening injury, like a shooting. And then in the pandemic, that work got supercharged because we were called upon to do COVID education. So we switched from Stop the Bleed to Stop the Virus. And you and I worked on some of that. We did the, you were on my podcast, What Matters to Me Most. I really appreciated that. And gosh, I saw your, by the way, I just got to say this. I saw your Instagram post. I think you were at a museum or I think it was a museum or a library. And it was a gathering of a bunch of really cool folks. And I was like, I saw you outside with folks again. And I was like, yes, Sean is outside. That made me so happy because I know that was a huge thing during the pandemic for you. But anyway, the pandemic really caused our work to explode. And we received funding in 2021 from the state, and then in 2022 from the city, and now in 2023 from the federal government to run our two programs. So the two programs we run now, again, are the BRIC and the T. And we have just got a grant through the support of Cori Bush to build a new center in North St. Louis. Yeah, so it's growing fast and mighty. Yes, it is. It's really amazing. The BRIC, again, is a clinic that sees over 100 visits a month, and it takes care of not just patients, but their families. When someone has been shot or threatened by a bullet, the T does mobile outreach as well as a brick and mortar clinic. And that takes care of people with really complex wounds, pain, or other issues related to drug use. There are some really, really nasty substances out there right now that are causing people to have really bad dependence and withdrawal and wounds. And we're doing our best to do harm reduction plus and support people so they can get well. So that's the work we do now. And I, again, just like we said earlier, I didn't plan it. I didn't plan any of this, but I'm so grateful for it because it's the reason why I went into medicine in the first place, which is to reduce suffering and help people take steps and actions and make choices and have power in their well-being, the way they define it, not just the way the healthcare system defines it.
Yes, yes. And I'll just share with the audience how I met you. So I met Dr. Punch in the TEDx St. Louis introductory meeting in 2019. And we were both part of the head-on healthcare event that May of 2018. And I loved his talk. Please go check that out, by the way. That being said, Dr. Punch, what made you want to be a public speaker and then audition for the TED Talk?
So, that's a good question. First of all, that experience was so wonderful. I learned a lot from you and others, and I'm very grateful. If you get a chance, anyone here listening gets a chance to try to do a TED talk, TEDx talk, do it, because man, you're gonna learn a lot. I guess I was a reluctant participant in that. I was nominated So I didn't make the choice to audition. I was nominated by one of the nurses in the ER who had worked with me and knew about my nonprofit work. Yeah. And I was like, what? What is this? I'm not going to do this. And I was really not sure. But I sat down with Elaine, you remember Elaine, and talked about what it would mean. And I was really moved by how much support. They called it, the Arch, TEDx Gateway Arch or something. Now it's called TEDx St. Louis, I think. Yeah. But anyway, they gave us a huge amount of support. You remember that? All those meetings and all those, that coaching. At the time, it seemed like, wow, it's taking a lot of time. But the truth is, it was invaluable because it wasn't that I wanted to be a public speaker, but I knew I had a powerful story. And my coaches in particular helped me discover my story. And they helped me not just discover my story, but they helped me discover the voice, which was this combination of me telling stories, you know, and I'm very sensitive to this, Sean, because I know how you've had to work to develop your voice, right? Literally. But they helped me find my voice, which I didn't even know I had, which was this combination of experience and expertise as a physician, but this lived human thing called life that I had in me. And I've continued those lessons. I use them today in the speaking I do now. And now you can't shut me up. I really want more and more and more and more opportunities to share. And I do talk a fair amount. And in fact, Sean, you'd be very excited to know, I'm working on a book. Yes. I'm trying to be like you.
Yes, that's very exciting. And so, because you are obviously one, very good at speaking, but also it's good to hear that we can look forward to more future speaking engagements from you. Uh-huh. And it was because of TED. I agree with everything you said. And I don't know if you saw, but I progressed to getting signed to a speaker agency.
I mean, I knew you were doing it, but I didn't even know you were in a situation like that. That's fantastic. Congratulations.
Thank you. And yeah, so we will definitely keep an eye out for any and all announcements from you, Dr. Punch, about future speaking engagements. And of course, we would encourage everyone who is listening, watching, reading to go ahead and give Dr. Punch that follow. You will not regret it. Yes. And yeah, as we wrap up, though, thank you so much for having this conversation with me. And I also definitely want to have you on to talk about your book at some point in the future. That would be amazing if you're able to. But was there anything else, though, that you wanted to discuss today that we didn't get to touch on?
Well, I just want to express gratitude to you, Sean, for your witness, for the way that you show up, for the way that you've encouraged me. You've encouraged me not just in my speaking and my work, but in my identity and just being so reinforcing of my transition and just supportive. It means a lot to me. It means a lot to me when people who knew me before my transition are really, really, really respectful of my identity now and support it. And like, you have done that in many ways. So it means the world to me. And also just the way that you are so willing to educate people out of their ignorance around disability. I did, and I do still have a lot of things to learn. And I'm here for it. So I'm going to keep following, and I look forward to working with you more in the future.
Yeah, Dr. LJ Punch, thank you again so much for coming on and having this conversation with me, for being you, for being vulnerable, for sharing all of it, all of it. And I hope you've enjoyed this as much as I did.
You bet.
And I really appreciate all of the insights you provided. And yeah, if anyone wanted to go ahead and connect with you and support the work that you do, where can they do so?
So I am on Instagram, and it's just LJ Punch. On Facebook as well. We have two websites, thetstl.com and thebrick.org. And you can find link trees on both of those Instagram sites for the TSTL and the Brick to get you linked to a ton of other resources, including if you have someone you know or love who is dealing with the impact of a bullet or is at risk for overdose and they're in the St. Louis region, send them our way. We do all of our care for free and you can refer yourself. And so please take advantage of the care we provide. That's the Brick and the T. Both of those locations are in the 5,000 blocks of Del Mar, at the Del Mar. We believe the Del Mar Divide is actually the meeting place for St. Louis. So look us up, LJ Punch. Again, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and otherwise.
Yeah, I will. Thank you for that. And I will absolutely make sure to share everything in my description below. And once again, I'm Sean Gold. Thank you for watching, reading, listening, being with us during this show. Make sure you like, comment all your thoughts, and subscribe. Also, make sure the bell is on to be notified of each upload. I'll see you all next time on another episode of Crippled by Culture.
Want to listen to Crippled by Culture on your favorite podcast platform? Well, now you can. Crippled by Culture is now available wherever you listen to podcasts. Just search up the show title and make sure you subscribe. Thank you for being a listener.